Thank you, Amiria. Tenakoto, tenakoto, tenakoto katoa. Today I have the privilege of introducing Richard Stallman, whose keynote speech is being sponsored by the School of Information Management at Victoria University of Wellington. Richard has been working to promote free software freedom for over 25 years. In 1983, he started the GNU project to develop a free operating system. And in 1985, he set up the Free Software Foundation. Every time you read or send a message to NZLibs, you use the Mailman software, which is part of the GNU project. So whether you realize it or not, Richard's work has touched all of your lives. I like to describe him as the most influential person most people have never heard of, although he tells me that that cannot be possibly be true because it cannot be tested. I know, I said that. I still like it. His ideas about software freedom, just a minute, I've lost my mouse. His ideas about software freedom and free access to information were used by Tim Berners-Lee when he created the world's first web server. And in 1999, his musings about a free online encyclopedia inspired Jimmy Wales to set up what is now Wikipedia. Today, Richard will be talking to us about copyright versus community in the age of computer networks and their implications for libraries. Richard.
Well, I've been in New Zealand for a couple of weeks, and in the North Island it was raining most of the time. Now I know why they call gumboots Wellingtons. And then I saw somebody who was making chairs and tables out of punga wood, and he called it furniture. And then we took the ferry to get here, and as soon as we got off, people started mocking and insulting us. But there were no hard feelings. They just wanted to make us really feel picked on. Well, I'm not going to continue. The reason people usually invite me to give speeches is because of my work on free software. This is not a talk about free software. This talk answers the question whether the ideas of free software extend to other kinds of works. But in order for that to make sense, I better tell you briefly what free software means. Free software is a matter of freedom, not price. So think of free speech, not free beer. Free software is software that respects the user's freedom. And there are four specific freedoms that the user deserves always to have. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code of the program and change it to make the program do what you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor. That's the freedom to redistribute copies of the program, exact copies, when you wish. And freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community. That's the freedom to publish your modified versions when you wish. So if the program gives you these four freedoms, then it's free software, which means the social system of its distribution and use is an ethical system, one that respects the user's freedom and the social solidarity of the user's community. But if one of these freedoms is missing or insufficient, then it's proprietary software, non-free software, user-subjugating software. It's unethical, it's not a contribution to society, it's a power grab. And this unethical practice should not exist. The goal of the free software movement is to put an end to it. All software should be free so that all users can be free. Proprietary software keeps the users divided and helpless. Divided because they're forbidden to share it, and helpless because they don't have the source code so they can't change it. And they can't even study it to verify what it's really doing to them. And many proprietary programs have malicious features to spy on the user, restrict the user, even backdoors to attack the user. For instance, Microsoft Windows has a backdoor with which Microsoft can forcibly install software changes without asking permission from the supposed owner of the computer. So you may think it's your computer, but if you've made the mistake of having Windows running in it, then really Microsoft has owned your computer. So computers need to be defenestrated, which means either throw Windows out of the computer or throw the computer out the window. But any proprietary software gives the developer unjust power over the users. Some of these developers abuse this power more and some abuse it less, but none of them ought to have it. You deserve to have control of your computing and not be forcibly dependent on a particular company. So you deserve free software. Well, at the end of speeches about free software, people sometimes ask whether these same ideas and freedoms apply to other things. Well, if you have a copy of a published work in your computer, it makes sense to ask whether you should have the same four freedoms, whether it's ethically essential that you have them or not. And that's the question I'm going to address today. If you have a copy of something that's not software, for the most part, the only thing that will that might deny you any of these freedoms is copyright law. With software, that's not so. The main ways of software making software non-free are contracts and withholding the source code from the users. Copyright is a sort of secondary backup method. But there's, for other things, there's no such distinction as between source code and executable code. For instance, if we're talking about a text, if you can see the text to read it, there's nothing in the text that you can't see. So it's not the same kind of issue exactly as software. So it's for the most part only copyright that might deny you these freedoms. So the same question can be restated: what should copyright law allow you to do with published works? And what should copyright law say? Copyright has developed along with copying technology, so it's useful to review the history of copying technology. Copying began in the ancient world, where it was done with a writing implement on a writing surface. You'd read one copy and write another. Now, this technology was rather inefficient, but other interesting characteristics were that it had no economy of scale. To write 10 copies would take 10 times as long as to write one copy. It required no special equipment other than the equipment for writing, and it required no special skill other than literacy itself. The result was that copies of any book were made in a decentralized manner. Wherever there was a copy, if someone wanted to copy it, he could. And there was nothing like copyright in the ancient world. If you had a copy and wanted to copy it, nobody was going to try to tell you you weren't allowed. Except if the local prince didn't like what the book said, in which case he might punish you for copying it. But that's not copyright, but rather something closely related, namely censorship. And to this day, copyright is often used in attempts to censor people. So that went on for thousands of years, but then there was a big advance in copying technology, namely the printing press. The printing press made copying a lot more efficient, but not uniformly, because mass production copying became a lot more efficient, but making one copy at a time didn't benefit from the printing press. In fact, you were better off just writing it by hand. That would be faster than trying to print one copy. So the printing press has an economy of scale. It takes a lot of work to set the type, but then you can make many copies very fast. Also, the printing press and the type were expensive equipment that most people didn't own, and the skill to use them, most literate people didn't know. To use the press was a different skill from writing. So the result was a centralized manner of producing copies. The copies of any given book would be made in a few places, and then they would be transported to wherever someone wanted to buy copies. Copyright began in the age of the printing press. For instance, copyright in England began as a system of censorship in the 1500s. I believe it was originally meant to censor Protestants, but it was turned around and used to censor Catholics, and presumably lots of others as well. So, according to this law, in order to publish a book, you had to get permission from the crown, and this permission was granted in the form of a perpetual monopoly to one publisher. Well, this was allowed to lapse in the 1680s, I believe, and the publishers wanted it back again, but what they got was something somewhat different. The Statute of Anne gave authors a copyright, and only for 14 years, although the author could renew it once. So this was a totally different idea, not a temporary monopoly for the author instead of a perpetual monopoly for the publisher. And the idea developed that copyright was a means of promoting writing. When the U.S. Constitution was written, some people wanted authors to be entitled to a copyright, but that was rejected. Instead, the U.S. Constitution says that Congress can optionally adopt a copyright law, but isn't required to. And if there is a copyright law, its purpose is to promote progress. In other words, the motive is not benefits for copyright holders or anyone they do business with, but for the general public. And copyright has to last a limited time. The publishers keep hoping to get us to forget about this. So here we have an idea of copyright, which is an industrial regulation on publishers, controlled by authors, and designed to provide benefits to the public at large. It functioned this way because it didn't restrict the readers. Now, in the early centuries of printing, and still, I believe, in the 1790s, lots of readers wrote copies by hand because they couldn't afford printed copies. But nobody ever expected copyright law to be something other than an industrial regulation. It wasn't meant to stop people from writing copies. It was meant to regulate the publishers. So because of this, it was easy to enforce, uncontroversial, and arguably beneficial for society. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers. And it's easy to find the unauthorized publishers of a book. You go to a bookstore and say, where do these copies come from? You don't have to invade everybody's home and everybody's computer to do that. It was uncontroversial because as the readers were not restricted, they had nothing to complain about. Well, theoretically, they were restricted from publishing, but not being publishers and not having printing presses, they couldn't do that anyway. In what they actually could do, they were not restricted. And it was arguably beneficial because the general public, according to the concepts of copyright law, traded away a theoretical right it was not in a position to exercise, and in exchange got the benefits of more writing. Now, if you trade away something you have no possible use for, and you get something that you can use in exchange, it's a positive trade. Now, whether or not you could have got a better deal some other way, that's a different question, but at least it's positive. So if this were still in the age of the printing press, I don't think I'd be complaining about copyright law. But the age of the printing press is gradually giving way to the age of the computer networks, another advance in copying technology that makes copying more efficient and, once again, not uniformly so. Here's what we had in the age of the printing press. Mass production, very efficient, one at a time copying, still just as slow as the ancient world. digital technology gets us here. They've both benefited, but one-off copying has benefited the most. So we get to a situation much more like the ancient world, where one-at-a-time copying is not so much worse than mass production copying. It's a little bit less efficient, a little bit less good, but it's perfectly cheap enough that hundreds of millions of people can do it. Consider how many people write CDs once in a while, even in poor countries. You may not have a CD writer yourself, so you go to a store where you could do it. So this means that copyright no longer fits in with the technology as it used to. Even if the words of copyright law had not changed, they wouldn't have the same effect. Instead of an industrial regulation on publishers controlled by authors with the benefits set up to go to the public, it is now a restriction on the general public controlled mainly by the publishers in the name of the authors. In other words, it's tyranny. It's intolerable, and we can't allow it to continue this way. As a result of this change, it is no longer easy to enforce, no longer uncontroversial, and no longer beneficial. It's no longer easy to enforce because now the publishers want to enforce it against each and every person. And to do this requires cruel measures, draconian punishments, invasions of privacy, abolition of our basic ideas of justice. There's almost no limit to how far they will propose to go to prosecute the war on sharing. It's no longer uncontroversial. There are political parties in several countries whose basic platform is freedom to share. And it's no longer beneficial because the freedoms that we conceptually traded away because we couldn't exercise them, we now can exercise, and they're tremendously useful, and we want to exercise them. So what would a democratic government do in this situation? It would reduce copyright power. It would say, the trade that we made on behalf of our citizens, trading away some of their freedom, which now they need, is intolerable. We have to change this. We can't trade away the freedom that is important. We can measure the sickness of democracy by the tendency of governments to do the exact opposite around the world, extending copyright power when they should reduce it. One example is in the dimension of time. Around the world, we see pressure to make copyright last longer and longer and longer. A wave of this started in the US in 1998. Copyright was extended by 20 years on both past and future works. Now, I do not understand how they hope to convince the now dead or senile writers of the 20s and 30s to write more back then by extending copyright on their works now. If they have a time machine with which to inform them, they haven't used it. Our history books don't say that there was a burst of vigor in the arts when in the 20s when all the artists found out that their copyrights would be extended in 1998. Now, it's theoretically conceivable that 20 more years of copyright on future works would convince people to make more effort in producing those works, but not anyone rational, because the discounted present value of 20 more years of copyright starting 75 years in the future if it's a work made for hire, and probably even longer if it's a work with an individual copyright holder, is so small it couldn't persuade any rational person to do anything different. And any business that wants to claim otherwise ought to present its projected balance sheets for 75 years in the future, which of course they can't do because none of them really looks that far ahead. The real reason for this law, the desire that prompted various companies to purchase this law in the U.S. Congress, which is how laws are decided on for the most part, was they had lucrative monopolies and they wanted those monopolies to continue. For instance, Disney was aware that the first film in which Mickey Mouse appeared would go into the public domain in a few years. And then anybody would be free to draw that same character as part of other works. Well, Disney didn't want that to happen. Disney borrows a lot from the public domain, but is determined never to give any slightest thing back. So Disney helped pay for this law, which we refer to as the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act. The movie companies say they want perpetual copyright, but the U.S. Constitution won't let them get that officially. So they came up with a way to get the same result unofficially, perpetual copyright on the installment plan. Every 20 years, they extend copyright 20 more years, so that at any given time, any given work has a date when it will supposedly fall into the public domain, but that date is like tomorrow. It never comes. By the time you get there, they will have postponed it, unless we stop them next time. Well, that's one dimension, the dimension of duration. But even more important is the dimension of breadth. Which uses of the work does copyright cover? And in the age of the printing press, copyright wasn't supposed to cover all the uses of a copyrighted work, because copyright regulated certain uses that were the exceptions in a broader space of unregulated uses. So there were certain things you were simply allowed to do with your copy of a book, for instance. Well, now the publishers have got the idea that they can turn our computers against us and use them to seize total power over all use of published works. They want to set up a pay-per-view universe, and they're doing it with DRM, Digital Restrictions Management, the intentional features of software that's designed to restrict the user. And often the computer itself is designed to restrict the user. The first way in which the general public saw this was in DVDs. The movie on a DVD is usually encrypted, and the format was secret. The DVD conspiracy kept this secret because they said, anyone that wants to make DVD players has to join the conspiracy, promise to keep the format secret, and promise to design the DVD players to restrict the users according to our rules, which say it has to stop the user from doing this, from doing that, from doing that, a precise set of requirements, all of which are malicious towards us. And it worked for a while, but then some people figured out this secret format and published free software capable of reading the movie on a DVD and playing it. Well, then the publishers said, since we can't actually stop them, we have to make it a crime. And they started that in the US in 1998 with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which imposed censorship on software capable of doing such jobs. So that particular piece of free software was the subject of a court case. Its distribution in the US is forbidden. The US practices censorship of software. But the movie companies are well aware that they can't really make that program disappear. It's easy enough to find it. So they designed another encryption system, which they hoped would be harder to break. And it's called AACS, or the AXE. And the AACS conspiracy makes precise rules about all players. For instance, in 2011, it's going to be forbidden to make analog video outputs. So all video outputs will have to be digital, and they will carry the signal encrypted into a monitor specially designed to keep secrets from the user, and that is malicious hardware. And they say that the purpose of this is to, quote, close the analog hole, unquote. I'll show you a couple of analog holes. Here's one, and here's another. But they'd like to poke out permanently. So how do I know about these conspiracies? The reason is they're not secret. They have websites. The AACS website proudly describes the contract that manufacturers have to sign, which is how I know about this requirement. It proudly states the names of the companies that established this conspiracy, which include Microsoft and Apple and Intel and Sony and Disney and IBM. Now, a conspiracy of companies to restrict the public's access to technology ought to be prosecuted as a serious crime, like a conspiracy to fix prices, except it's worse. So the prison sentences for this should be longer. But these companies are quite confident that our governments are on their side against us. They have no fear of being prosecuted for these conspiracies, which is why they don't bother to hide them. And in general, DRM is set up by a conspiracy of companies. Once in a while, a single company can do it. But generally, it requires a conspiracy between technology companies and publishers. So almost always a conspiracy. Now, they thought that nobody would ever manage to break the axe. But about 3.5 years ago, someone released a free program capable of decrypting that format. However, it was totally useless because in order to run it, you need to know the key. And then 6 months later, I saw a photo of two adorable puppies with 32 hex digits above them. And I wondered, why put those two things together? I wonder if those numbers are some important key. And someone could have put the numbers together with the puppies, figuring people would copy the photo of the puppies because they were so cute, and this would protect the key from being wiped out. And that's what it was. That was the key to break the axe. And people posted it, and editors deleted it because essentially laws in many countries now conscript them to censor this information. And it was posted again, they deleted, eventually they gave up. And in 2 weeks, this number was posted in over 700,000 websites. Well, that's a big outpouring of public disgust with DRM, but it didn't win the war because the publishers changed the key. And not only that, with HD DVD, this was adequate to break the DRM, but not with Blu-ray, because Blu-ray has an additional level of DRM. And so far, there is no free software that can break it. Which means that you must regard Blu-ray discs as something incompatible with your own freedom. They are an enemy with which no accommodation is possible. At least not with our present level of knowledge. Never accept any product designed to attack your freedom. So if you don't have the free software to play a DVD, you mustn't buy or rent any DVDs or accept them even as gifts, except for the rare non-encrypted DVDs, which there are a few of. I actually have a few. I don't have any encrypted DVDs. I won't take them. So this is how things stand in video, but we've also seen DRM in music. For instance, about 10 years ago, we started to see things that looked like compact discs, but they weren't written quite like compact discs. They didn't follow the standard. We called them corrupt discs. And the idea of them was that they would play in an audio player, but it was impossible to read them on a computer. But these different methods had various problems. Eventually, Sony came up with a clever idea. They put a program on the disc so that if you stuck the disc into a computer, the disc would install the program, and this program was designed like a virus to take control of the system. It's called a rootkit, meaning that it has things in it to break the security of the system so that it can install the software deep inside the system and modify various parts of the system. For instance, it modified the command you could use to examine the system to see if the software was present, so as to disguise itself. And it modified the command you could use to delete some of these files so that it wouldn't really delete them. Now, all of this is a serious crime. But it's not the only one Sony committed, because this software also included code, free software code, that had been released under the GNU General Public License. Now, the GNU GPL is a copyleft license, and that means it says, yes, you're free to put this code into other things, but when you do, the entire program you put it into, you must release as free software under the same license, and you must make the source code available to the users, and to inform them of their rights, you have to give them a copy of this license when they get the software. And Sony didn't comply with all that. That's commercial copyright infringement, which is a felony. They're both felonies, but Sony wasn't prosecuted because the government understands its job is to, that the purpose of the government and the laws is to maintain the power of those companies over us, not to help defend our freedom in any way. But people got angry and they sued Sony. However, they made a mistake. They focused their condemnation not on the evil purpose of this scheme, but only on the secondary evils of the various methods that Sony used. So Sony settled the lawsuits and promised that in the future when it attacks our freedom, it will not do those other things. Well, actually that particular corrupt disk scheme was not so bad, because if you were not using Windows, it wouldn't affect you at all. And even if you were using Windows, there's a key on the keyboard. If you remembered every time to hold it down, then the disk wouldn't install the software. But of course, it's hard to remember that every time, you know. You're going to slip up someday. Anyway, this shows the kind of thing we've had to deal with. Fortunately, music DRM is receding. Even the main record companies sell downloads without DRM. But we see a renewed effort to impose DRM on books. You see, the publishers want to take away the traditional freedoms of book readers. Freedom to do things such as borrow a book from the public library or lend it to a friend, to sell a book to a used bookstore, or buy it anonymously paying cash, which is the only way I buy books. We've got to resist the temptations to let Big Brother know everything that we're doing. And even the freedom to keep the book as long as you wish and read it as many times as you wish, they plan to get rid of. And the way they do it is with DRM. You see, they knew that so many people read books and would get angry if these freedoms were taken away, that they didn't believe they could buy a law specifically to abolish these freedoms. There'd be too much opposition. Democracy is sick, but once in a while people manage to demand something. So they came up with a two-stage plan. First, take away these freedoms from e-books, and second, convince people to switch from paper books to e-books. And they've succeeded in stage one. In the US, they did it with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And in New Zealand, they've That was part of the year ago Copyright Act. Censorship on distribution of software that can break DRM was part of that law. And that's an unjust provision. It's got to be repealed. Well, the second stage is convince people to switch from printed books to e-books. And that didn't go so well. One publisher in 2001 had the idea they would make their line of e-books really popular if they started it with my biography. So they found an author, and the author asked me if I'd cooperate, and I said, only if this book is published as an e-book without encryption, without DRM. Publisher wouldn't go along with that, and I just stuck to it, and I said no. Eventually, we found another publisher who was willing to do this, and in fact, willing to publish the book under a free license, giving you the four freedoms. So the book was written and published and sold a lot of copies on paper. But in any case, ebooks failed at the beginning of this decade. People just didn't want to read them very much. And I said, they will try again. And we saw an amazing number of news articles about electronic ink, or was it electronic paper? I can never remember which. And it occurred to me, probably the reason there's so many is the publishers want us to think about this. They want us to be eager for the next generation of ebook readers. And now they're upon us. Things like the Sony Shredder. Well, its official name is the Sony Reader, but if you put on SH, it explains what it's designed to do to your books. And the Amazon Swindle, designed to swindle you out of your traditional freedoms without your noticing. Well, of course, they call it the Kindle, which expresses what it's going to do to your books. The Kindle is an extremely malicious product, almost about as malicious as Microsoft Windows. They both have spy features, they both have digital restrictions management, and they both have back doors. In the case of the Kindle, the only way you can buy a book is to buy it from Amazon, and Amazon requires you to identify yourself, so they know everything that you've bought. And then there's digital restrictions management so that you can't lend the book or sell it to a used bookstore, and the library can't lend it either. And then there's a back door, which we found out about 3 months ago, because Amazon used it. Amazon sent a command to order all the Kindles to erase a particular book, namely 1984 by George Orwell. Yes. They couldn't have picked a more ironic book to erase. So that's how we know that Amazon has a backdoor with which it can erase books remotely. What else it can do, who knows? Maybe it's like Microsoft Windows. Maybe Amazon can remotely upgrade the software, which means whatever malicious things are not in it now, they could put them in tomorrow. This is intolerable. Any one of these restrictions is intolerable. They want to create a world where nobody lends books to anybody anymore. Imagine that you visit a friend and there are no books on the shelf. Of course, it's not that your friend doesn't read, but his books are all inside a device, and of course, he can't lend you those books. The only way he could lend you any one of those books is to lend you his whole library, which is obviously a ridiculous thing to ask anybody to do. So there goes friendship for people who love books. Make sure that you inform people what this device implies. It means other readers will no longer be your friends because you will be acting like a jerk towards them. Spread the word preemptively. This device is your enemy. It's the enemy of everyone who reads. And the people who don't recognize that are the people who are thinking so short term that they don't see it. it's our job to help them see beyond the momentary convenience to the implications of this device. Now, I have nothing against distributing books in digital form if they are not designed to take away our freedom. So, strictly speaking, it's possible to have an e-book reader which is not designed to attack you, which runs free software and not proprietary software, which doesn't have DRM, which doesn't make you identify yourself to get a book, which doesn't have a backdoor, which doesn't restrict what you can do with the files on your own machine. It's possible, but the companies, the big companies really pushing e-books are doing it to attack our freedom, and we mustn't stand for that. So, this is what governments are doing in cahoots with big business to attack our freedom by making copyright harsher and nastier and more restrictive than ever before. But what should they do? Well, governments should make copyright power less. Here are my specific proposals. First of all, there is the there's the dimension of time. I propose copyright should last 10 years starting from the date of publication of a work. Why 10 years? Well, first of all, why from the date of publication? Because before that, we don't have copies. So it doesn't matter to us whether we would have been allowed to copy our copies that we don't have. So I figure we might as well let the authors have as much time as it takes to arrange publication, and then start the clock. But why 10 years? Well, I don't know about this country, but in the US, the publication cycle has got shorter and shorter. Nowadays, almost all books are remaindered within 2 years and out of print within three. So 10 years is more than three times the usual publication cycle. That should be plenty comfortable. But not everybody agrees. I once proposed this in a panel discussion with fiction writers, and the award-winning fantasy writer next to me said, 10 years? No way. Anything more than 5 years is intolerable. You see, he had a legal dispute with his publisher. His book seemed to be out of print, but the publisher wouldn't admit it. The publisher was using the copyright on his own book to stop him from distributing copies himself, which he wanted to do so people would could read it. And this is what every artist starts out wanting to distribute her work so it will get read and so it'll be, and appreciated. And very few make a lot of money. And that tiny fraction face the danger of being morally corrupted like J.K. Rowling. J.K. Rowling in Canada got an injunction against people who had bought her book in a bookstore, ordering them not to read it. So in response, I call for a boycott of Harry Potter books. But I don't say you shouldn't read them. I leave that to the author and the publisher. I just say you shouldn't buy them. But that it's so few authors who make enough money that they can be corrupted in this way. Most of them don't get anywhere near that, and they continue wanting the same thing they wanted at the outset. They want their work to be appreciated. He wanted to distribute his own book, and copyright was stopping him. He realized that more than 5 years of copyright was unlikely to ever do him any good. Well, if people would rather have copyright last 5 years, I won't be against it. I propose 10 as a first stab at the problem. Let's reduce it to 10 years, and then take stock for a while, and we could adjust it after that. I don't say I think 10 years is the exact right number. I don't know. But what about the dimension of breadth? Which activities should copyright cover? I distinguish three broad categories of works. First of all, there are the functional works that you use to do a practical job in your life, and this includes software, recipes, educational works, reference works, text fonts, and other things you can think of. These works should be free. If you use the work to do a job in your life, then if you can't change the work to suit you, you don't control your life. And once you've changed the work to suit you, then you've got to be free to publish it, publish your version, because there are others who will want the changes you made. And this leads quickly to the conclusion that users have to have the same four freedoms, not just for software, and you'll notice that for recipes, practically speaking, cooks are always sharing and changing recipes just as if their recipes were free. And imagine how people would react if the government tried to stamp out so-called recipe piracy. The term pirate is pure propaganda. When people ask me what I think of music piracy, I say, as far as I know, when pirates attack, they don't do it by playing instruments badly, they do it with arms. So it's not music piracy. Because piracy is attacking ships, and sharing is not as far as you can get from being the moral equivalent of attacking ships. Attacking ships is bad, sharing with other people is good, so we should firmly reject and denounce that propaganda term piracy whenever we hear it. Anyway, people might have objected 20 years ago, if we don't give up our freedom, if we don't let the publishers of these works control us, the works won't get made and that'll be a horrible disaster. Well, now, looking at the free software community, at all the recipes that circulate, at reference works like Wikipedia, we can even start to see free textbooks being published. We know that that fear is misguided. There is no need to despair and give up our freedom thinking that otherwise the works won't get made. And there are lots of ways to encourage them to get made if we want more. Lots of ways that are consistent with and respect our freedom. So in this category, they should all be free. But what about the second category of works that say what certain people thought, like memoirs, essays of opinion, scientific papers, and various other things? Well, to publish a modified version of somebody else's statement of what he thought is misrepresenting somebody. That's not particularly a contribution to society. And therefore, it is workable and acceptable to have a somewhat reduced copyright system where all commercial use is covered by copyright and all modification is covered by copyright, but everyone is free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies. That freedom is the minimum freedom we must establish for all published works, because the denial of that freedom is what creates the war on sharing, what creates the vicious propaganda that says that sharing is theft, that sharing is like being a pirate and attacking ships. Absurdities, but absurdities backed by a lot of money that has corrupted our governments. So we need to end the war on sharing. We need to legalize sharing exact copies of any published work. But in the second category of works, that's all we need. We don't need to make them free. And therefore, I think it's okay to have the reduced copyright system, which covers commercial use and all modification, and this will provide a revenue stream to the authors in more or less the same, usually inadequate way as the present system. You got to keep in mind, the present system, except for superstars, is usually totally inadequate. What about works of art and entertainment? Well, here, it took me a while to decide what to think about modification. You see, on the one hand, a work of art can have an artistic integrity and modifying it could destroy that. Of course, copyright doesn't necessarily stop works from being butchered that way. Hollywood does it all the time. But on the other hand, modifying a work can be a contribution to art, and it makes possible the folk process, which can lead to things that are beautiful and rich. But even if we look at named authors only, consider Shakespeare, who borrowed stories from other works a few decades old and did them in different ways and made important works of literature. If today's copyright law had existed then, that would have been forbidden and those plays wouldn't have been written. But eventually I realized, yes, modifying a work of art can be a contribution to art, but you don't have to, it's not desperately urgent in most cases. If you had to wait 10 years for the copyright to expire, you could wait that long. Not like the present-day copyright law that makes you wait maybe 75 years or 95 years, or in Mexico you might have to wait almost 200 years in some cases, because copyright in Mexico expires 100 years after the author dies. What the author writes when young, you might have to wait almost 200 years. This is insane. But 10 years, as I've proposed, copyright should last, that people can wait. So I propose the same partly reduced copyright system that covers commercial use and modification, but everyone's got to be free to non-commercially redistribute exact copies. And then after 10 years, it goes into the public domain, and people can contribute to art by publishing their modified versions. Oh, and one other thing. If you're going to take little pieces out of a bunch of works and rearrange them into something totally different, that should just be legal. Because the purpose of copyright is to promote art, not to obstruct art. It's stupid to apply copyright to using snippets like that. It's self-defeating. It's a kind of distortion that you'd only get when the government is basically under the control of the publishers of the existing successful works and has totally lost sight of its intended purpose. So that's what I propose, and in particular, this means that sharing copies on the internet must be legal. Sharing is good. Sharing builds the bonds of society. To attack sharing is to attack society. So anytime the government proposes some new means to attack people who share and stop them from sharing, we have to recognize that this is evil, not just because the means proposed almost invariably offend basic ideas of justice, but that's not a coincidence. The reason for that is because the purpose is evil. Sharing is good and the government should encourage sharing. But copyright did, after all, have a useful purpose. Copyright as a means to carry out that purpose has a problem now because it doesn't fit in with the technology we use. It interferes with vital freedom for all the readers, listeners, viewers, and whatever. But the goal of promoting the arts is still desirable. So I have two other ways to propose to do this with. In addition to the partly reduced copyright system, which would continue to be a copyright system, but I propose two other methods. One is taxes. Distribute tax money directly to artists. Now, this could be a special tax, perhaps on internet connectivity, or it could come from general revenue, because it won't be that much money in total, not if it's distributed in an efficient way. Now, to distribute it efficiently to promote the arts means not in linear proportion to popularity. It should be based on popularity, because we don't want bureaucrats having the discretion to decide which artists to support and which to ignore. But based on popularity does not imply linear proportion. What I propose is measure the popularity of the various artists, which you could do through polling samples, in which nobody's required to participate, and then take the cube root. The cube root looks like this, which means basically that it tapers off after a while. So if Superstar A is 1,000 times as popular as successful artist B, with this system, A would get 10 times as much money as B. Not 1,000 times. Linearly would give A 1,000 times as much as B, which means that if we want B to get enough to live on, we're going to have to make A tremendously rich. Now this is wasteful use of the tax money. Shouldn't be done. But if we make it taper off, then yes, each superstar will get handsomely more than an ordinary successful artist, but the total of all the superstars will be a small fraction of the money. Most of the money will go to support a large number of fairly successful artists, of fairly appreciated artists, fairly popular artists. And thus, the system will use money a lot more efficiently than the existing system. The existing system is regressive. It actually gives far, far more per listen, per record, for instance, to a superstar than to anybody else. So the money is extremely badly used. So the result is we'd actually be paying a lot less this way. I hope that's enough to mollify some of these people who have a knee-jerk hostile reaction to taxes, one that I don't share because I believe in a welfare state. But I have another suggestion, which is voluntary payments. Suppose every player had a button you could push to send a dollar to the artist who made the work you're currently playing or the last one you played. And this money would be delivered anonymously to those artists. I think a lot of people would push that button fairly often. For instance, all of us, we could afford to push that button once every day, and we wouldn't miss that much money. It's not that much money for us, I'm pretty sure. Of course, there are poor people who couldn't afford to push it ever. And it's okay if they don't. We don't need to squeeze money out of poor people to support the artists. There are enough people who are not poor to do the job just fine. Now, I'm sure you're aware that a lot of people really love certain art and are really happy to support the artists. And an idea just came to me. The player could also give you a certificate of having supported so-and-so. And it could even maybe count up how many times you had done it and give you a certificate that says, I sent so much to these artists. There are various ways we can encourage people who want to do it. For instance, we could have a PR campaign which is friendly and kind and say, have you sent a dollar to some artists today? Why not? It's only a dollar. You'll never miss it. And don't you love what they're doing? Push the button. And it'll make people feel good. And they'll think, yeah, I just loved that, what I just watched. Oh, I'll send a dollar. This is already starting to work to some extent. There's a Canadian singer who used to be called Jane Siberry, and she put her music on her website and invited people to download it and pay whatever amount they wished. And she reported getting an average of more than a dollar per copy, which is interesting because the major record companies charge just under a dollar per copy. So by letting people decide whether and how much to pay, she got more. She got even more per visitor who was actually downloading something, but this may not even count whether there was an effect of bringing more people to come and increasing the total number that this average was against. So it can work, but it's a pain in the neck under present circumstances. You've got to have a credit card to do it. And that means you can't do it anonymously. And you've got to go find where you're going to pay. And the payment systems for those small amounts, they're not very efficient. So the artists are only getting half of it. If we set up a good system for this, it would work far, far better. So these are my two suggestions. And you can also see in mecenaglobal.org, mecenat-global.org. You can find another scheme that combines aspects of the two, which was invented by Francis Muguet and designed to fit in with existing legal systems better to make it easier to enact. But be careful of proposals to, quote, compensate the rights holders, unquote, because when they say compensate, they're trying to presume that if you have appreciated a work, you now have a specific debt to somebody, and that you have to, quote, compensate that somebody, unquote. And when they say rights holders, it's supposed to make you think it's supporting artists while in fact referring to the publishers, the same publishers who basically exploit all the artists except the few that you've really, that you've all heard of, who are so popular that they have clout. So we don't owe a debt. We have nobody that we have to, quote, compensate, unquote, but supporting the arts is still a useful thing to do. That was the motivation for copyright back when copyright fit in with the technology of the day. Today, copyright is a bad way to do it, but it's still good to do it in other ways that respect our freedom. Now, this is the end of my talk, except I'm going to answer questions if you'll let me. But I want to point out that at the Lianza stand, there are copies of my book of essays for sale for $30 New Zealand, and I will sign them at 2:30. You can go buy them now, but at 2:30 is when I'll be there to sign them. And I can accept payment by credit cards when I'm there. Now I think you'd have to pay cash. We also have various gadgets for sale. The money all goes to the Free Software Foundation to support our campaign for computer users' freedom and demand that they change the two evil parts of the Copyright Act. They shouldn't replace the three strikes punishment for sharing, because sharing is good, and they've got to get rid of the censorship for the software to break DRM. And beware of ACTA. They're trying to negotiate a treaty between various countries for all of these countries to attack their citizens, and we don't know how because they won't tell us.
Thank you very much, Richard. We are slightly over time, so I think that means that questions are going to have to be very brief. Can we give him any time for questions, or shall we move on? All right, you can accost him if you can find him.
Oh, well, so too bad. You know, it didn't start counting until just a minute or two
ago.
I know.
It was supposed to start counting at 5 minutes, and it started at 30 seconds.
And not only that, it timed your... I took maybe an extra minute, but there were supposed to be 10 minutes.
That's fine. I've got two things I want to say. Last year we had Lawrence Lessig as a keynote speaker at the Lianza conference. In the introduction to his book, Free Culture, The Nature and Future of Creativity, Lessig said, the inspiration for the title and much of the argument for this book comes from the work of Richard Stallman and the Free Software Foundation. As I reread the essays in Free Software, Free Society, I realize that all of the theoretical insight I develop here are insights that Stallman described years ago. I think that's a real tribute. And if you want to read those books, those essays for yourself, Richard has just told you where you can get a copy. We have a limited number. I think it's actually going to be at 3:15 during the tea break that he'll be signing them. We've got something else for him to do right now, but think about buying one. You're not likely to have a chance to have this happen again, so it is a special time. And I would just like to ask you to join me once more in thanking Richard for a very interesting speech. And I'm supposed to give these to him. Richard.